motorcycle and bombing down the freeway at over 100 miles an hour. If he's driving his car, he's not paying attention to the rules of the road. He rolls through all the stop signs. You would think somebody who's the East Area Rapist, Golden State Killer, the original Night Stalker, would be doing everything within the law to prevent from being contacted. But how did he not slip up over all these years?
It's possible that at this point in his life, the suspect feels unstoppable because he's gotten away with his crimes for so long. He's clearly a risk taker. Maybe he loves the rush. But despite this brazen behavior, he might still be trying to avoid being caught.
One night, Ken calls me and said, "Hey, our boy just did a gypsy run." He said the guy tried to slip surveillance. And he proceeded to tell me how D'Angelo got into his car and got on the freeway and was doing counter-surveillance maneuvers to try to determine whether or not he was being followed. And I was like, "Did you guys get made?" He goes, "I don't think so. It's one of those things we don't know. Did he do that routinely because he was paranoid? Or did he actually see something?" So they had to back away at a point in time because they did not want him to figure out he was under surveillance. That's when the decision was made, we've got to do whatever we can to get this surreptitious sample. He's not a guy that's going to Starbucks and leaving a cup with DNA behind. He was routinely going to auto parts stores or the Hobby Lobby, and at a point when he parked his car and went into this Hobby Lobby store, an undercover agent went up and swabbed his car door handle, and that was submitted to the lab. Meanwhile, I'm out in Colorado Springs. I'm looking for houses and ultimately put an offer on a house, and my wife and I go to celebrate that, and we go and eat at P.F. Chang's in Colorado Springs. And as I'm sitting there, had finished eating dinner, my cell phone lights up.
I immediately called Paul Holes. Paul was actually with his wife at P.F. Chang's.
It's Kirk Campbell from SAC-DA's office. Okay, I'm getting an update, hold on, and I excuse myself. People are coming in and out, you know, from the restaurant. And Kirk, first thing he says is, "You absolutely cannot tell anybody what I'm about to tell you." And I immediately knew, okay, there's something up here. And Kirk tells me, "We got the DNA results back, and I don't entirely know what they've got, but the lab is really excited about what they're seeing." And I was like, "Well, what did they tell you?" He says, "There's like a partial profile, but it's like 20 markers that match." And I knew, because of my DNA experience, it's the guy. And I told Kirk that. That's him. And there's no question. So we hang up. I go back inside. And at this point, the fortune cookies had been delivered. My wife had opened up her fortune cookie, and I don't remember the exact phrase, but it had something to do with, "You will find the perfect home." And so she was super excited with the fact that we had just put an offer on a house. And I sit down. She claims that my face was white, and I don't believe that for a second. All I knew was, is I'm not telling her inside this restaurant, because I know what her reaction is going to be, and I can't alert the restaurant, everybody here, what the heck is going on. So I'm just sitting there as the waiter comes and he's taking the dishes away, and she's looking at me and she's going, "What did Kirk want?" And I didn't respond. And she was like, "Do they have DNA results?" And I just did a single nod. And she said, "No." I remember her kind of sitting a little bit straighter up because she's a former DNA analyst. And I just gave another single nod and she says, "No way." And I just gave another single nod. And all of a sudden she's squealing and it's like, we got to get out of here before she just explodes in this spasm of emotions. And so we stand up and she's literally pushing me out the restaurant to our car. I know at this point, I had invested 24 years in this case. The last 10 years was 24/7 trying to solve this thing. After all that time, we had done it. But we still had stuff to do. SAC DA's office wants a second sample, one that will generate a full profile. I finish my business out in Colorado Springs, fly back, and first thing that Monday morning, we are putting together the arrest warrant. Sacramento Sheriff's Office put in a plan in order to get some of D'Angelo's trash when he pushed it out onto the street, and the crime lab located a piece of tissue that contained DNA material. We had a 100% match across all the markers to the Golden State Killer. So, April 24th, 2018, that's when the arrest warrant was signed. We are standing right in front of D'Angelo's house. He was probably 20 feet away from where we're standing. This is a guy that we know is willing to kill. He's killed multiple people. He's even shot at an officer in his criminal history. We know he's got guns. We don't want him going back into the house where he has family members that he could keep hostage. This is not something where you just walk up to the front door, knock, and have him answer. He could be walking to the front door with a gun in hand. We've got to arrest him while he's out in front of his house. I was able to listen to it from the war room where myself, the FBI agents, and the Ventura detectives were sitting. All we could hear was the voice of the team leader, and he just said, "It's a go." And at that point, the entire war room goes silent. When you're in law enforcement, you know bad things can occur during this type of process. We're sitting there on pins and needles, waiting to get an update. And then at a certain point, we hear, "Suspect in custody." The entire room just erupted. Guys jumping out of their chairs. They're high-fiving each other. There's a lot of woo-hoos. And I'm kind of sitting there in my mind. I'm now in my action mode. Okay, East Area Rapist Golden State Killer is in custody. He's coming in for an interview. And this is going to be a long night.
So I'm sitting in my room at my desk. I read this email. There's something going on with the case. Have you heard anything?
I got this phone call. It's this detective, a retired detective from Sacramento Sheriff's Department. And he said, "You don't know me, but I grew up down the street from your family. I just want to be the first one to tell you we have the East Area Rapist in custody." And I couldn't believe it. I was so happy. It was just beyond me. But then he said, "You can't tell a soul. This won't even be made public until tomorrow. They're going to have a news conference at noon tomorrow. You can't tell anyone." Well, we got off the phone, and I immediately called Debbie Domingo.
And I said, "Whoa, Margaret, slow down. Who is this source?" And she says, "I know this is right. They got him." "I'm so happy," she says. "I'm so happy." I said, "I'm happy for you, but," I said, "that doesn't sound like an official source to me." And she says, "Who should I call?" And I'm like, "Margaret." I said, "What do you mean, who should you call? I'm not calling anybody until I know this is real." And she says, "Well, I'm calling everybody." I said, "Okay, fine, Margaret."
I tried Jane. She was out of the country at the time.
I found out he was caught when I received a text on my phone from retired Detective Larry Crompton.
"Richard Shelby emailed me and said, 'There's a rumor. Did you hear that they arrested these air rapists?'" I thought, "No, I hadn't heard that." So I called Larry Poole and I said, "Larry, did you hear that they have arrested these air rapists, Riddle Night Stalker?" And he said, "No, I hadn't."
I actually got a phone call from Paul and Steve.
I was sitting at my desk, and somebody just walked by and said, "Hey, that's pretty cool. They caught the original Night Stalker." I was like, "What do you mean?"
He said, "Carol, we've just identified who the East Area Rapist is." I said, "You're kidding." I just couldn't believe it. I talked to Jane, and I felt bad because Jane started crying and crying. And then I'm crying, and I said, "Jane, I got more phone calls to make. I can't listen to you cry."
And I was just so happy and excited. And, oh, my gosh, I was just trying to process it all. That was it. I mean, it was just such a good feeling.
I probably used a few words I shouldn't have said.
My husband and I, at that time, were in a hotel room, and we screamed and we cried, and oh my goodness, we woke up all the guests in the hotel.
And everything inside me was just
I
was overjoyed. I couldn't stop smiling. I couldn't go to sleep that night.
It was a very long journey and a very quick ending.
D'Angelo is put into the interview room. Unfortunately, I did not get the opportunity to be able to sit across the table and ask D'Angelo questions, but I watched.
My name is Steve Rhodes. Mr. D'Angelo chose not to speak. I straight up told him, I said, you're here because of your DNA being inside of Charlene Smith. I just straight out accused him, and then you killed her, beat her to death with a log. His response was, I didn't kill anybody. And then he started talking out loud to himself. And I told him, you're going to jail, and I walked out.
I saw a defeated man. I saw somebody who never thought this day would come. The magnitude of finding D'Angelo did not set in that night. About 3 a.m. in the morning, decided I need to go home and get some sleep as we were going to show up at D'Angelo's house first thing in the morning to get a walkthrough before the evidence processing work was to occur. So I go home, I get some sleep, I come back, and I go out to D'Angelo's house. We get led through. It was fascinating finally seeing how this man lived, this guy I had been looking for so long. The most notable thing that I saw, he had a computer set up, and that monitor was covered by a towel. That struck me immediately because the East Area Rapist, when he would take the female victim and pull her out into the family room, before he started the sexual assault, he would turn on the TV, keep the sound off, and then put a towel over it in order to get that low light illumination so he could see her, so he could see her body, so he could see the fear in her face. And here he was as a 72-year-old man with a towel over his computer monitor. My immediate thought was, he's replicating the crime scene from way back in the day. He's continuing to fantasize about what he did to these victims back in the 1970s. After that walkthrough, I had to get out to the press conference that will announce to the world that the Golden State Killer was finally caught. So I drive from D'Angelo's house to get out to the Sacramento DA's office crime lab where the press conference is going to be held. And I get there, I'm in a meeting where there's the planning of how the politicians are going to be presenting, what politician is going to be speaking when, and then we go out, and now Anne Marie Schubert makes the announcement that Joseph James D'Angelo has been arrested for being the Golden State Killer.
The man known as the East Area Rapist and Golden State Killer terrorized Sacramento and California neighborhoods in the 1970s and 80s. Investigators now have a suspect.
We turn now to Sacramento, California, where authorities today announced the arrest of a suspect in the decades-old Golden State Killer case. Here's Sacramento County District Attorney Anne Marie Schubert.
We found the needle in the haystack, and it was right here in Sacramento.
The press conference is over and everybody's dispersing. I agreed to meet up with the small team that did the investigative genealogy work at a local restaurant for lunch in a mini celebration that, hey, we got here. I'm driving to that restaurant. My cell phone lights up and I look down and I see the name of one of the victims who I'd spoken to about 10 years prior. And she did not want to meet with me back then. She was so scared. She was a victim who was 13 years old when this guy came in and raped her while her father was sleeping in the bedroom next door. And I say hi. And on the other end, I hear this meek voice. And she's saying, and asking, is it him? Is it really him? And I responded, yes, it's him, and he will never get out to hurt anybody else again. Then all I hear on the other end is just an explosion of sobbing. And she is sobbing for like 20 seconds. And then she gathers herself saying, I'm sorry, I'm not upset, I'm just so happy. She had lived in fear, thinking that he would come back. And now knowing that he can't was liberating. When I hung up, it was at that moment that I realized that I had made a difference. So when I arrived for the lunch with the genealogy team, I had a little bit more pep in my step because finally it sunk in that what we had done meant so much to so many people.
Chapter 13. Who is Joseph DeAngelo?
He was a nameless, faceless person. He wasn't anyone that I could point the finger at and say, that's the guy that did this to me. He was just maybe out there, maybe he wasn't, maybe he was dead, and maybe we'll never know who he is. Now there's a person, now there's a man named Joseph DeAngelo that did this to me, that did this to a 13-year-old.
After it was revealed that Joseph James DeAngelo's DNA matched that of the Golden State Killer, the world ravenously followed the news and rushed to the internet to find out any information they could.
I'll just say it. I would be one of the people that was at home constantly hitting refresh on Google, wanting to know, oh my gosh, who was it? Where did he live? You know, what is the backstory?
I get on Facebook and I start looking for this Joseph DeAngelo.
I immediately wanted to see what this guy looked like. I wanted to know if this was somebody that I knew. If my mom knew him, if we were friends with him or acquaintances, or was he in Janelle's phone book? Who was this guy? I saw his face and I just did not recognize him. His pictures when he was younger don't look like anybody that we knew or hung out with. And I've asked my friends, do any of you know this guy or did you know him in the past? And nobody knew him.
Here's what we know about Joseph DeAngelo at the time of this recording. He was born in 1945 in Bath, New York. He attended middle school in Rancho Cordova, the very area where many of his East Area Rapist attacks occurred. He then went on to graduate in June 1964 from Folsom High School in a nearby suburb of Sacramento.
After high school, he joined the Navy. He was in the Navy for 4 years.
According to local reports at the time, Joseph DeAngelo saw 22 months of combat in the Vietnam War.
And then he ends up going to school, studying criminal justice, was an intern at Roseville PD. He was engaged at one point to this Bonnie, and they never got married. And then in 1973, he marries his wife. So he is married at the time of the Visalia Ransacker series. And at the time of Visalia Ransacker, he is a full-time police officer for Exeter PD and ultimately promoted up to a sergeant at Exeter.
Exeter is a small town in the San Joaquin Valley about 200 miles south of Sacramento. In 1973, a brief article in the Exeter Sun newspaper announces Joseph DeAngelo as a new officer on the Exeter Police Force. Ironically, it says, James DeAngelo Jr. believes that without law and order, there can be no government. And without a democratic government, there can be no freedom. Law enforcement is his career, he says, and his job is serving the community.
My name's Nick Willick. Joseph DeAngelo came to work for the Auburn Police Department in 1976.
1976 is also the year the East Area Rapist attacks begin. The small city of Auburn is only 30 miles away from the east side of Sacramento.
He had worked 3 years down at Exeter Police Department. I don't really know much about his background at that point. At that time, I was a patrol sergeant. I did have the opportunity to work a few times with Joe DeAngelo on the street. Joe DeAngelo was, he didn't really fit what you would call the typical mold of a police officer. He didn't have the personality traits that most officers have. He was probably, if you would rate him, probably below average officer. He lacked in what I believe to be officer safety techniques. And I know that on several occasions I called him out on those. And he wasn't very susceptible to criticism. Matter of fact, he would kind of pout after you told him that, hey, you should do this way. He had oddities. He really did. He had a nickname of Junk Food Joey. And he was all the time this can of soda pop or a bag of potato chips in his hands, you know, something. He was eating all the time, licorice. Like I said, he was, I thought, didn't exhibit good officer safety practices. One time I was, as a sergeant, I responded to a silent alarm, and I was crossing in front of the building, and he came up to the front of the building and illuminated me with the alley lights in front of the glass. And it was a false alarm. It wasn't a major thing, but it was definitely a mistake. I gave him a verbal reprimand for that. And like I said, then he'd kind of pout after that. He also had a tendency to violate people's space. He would, officers as well as citizens. As a lieutenant one time, received a complaint about him, and the citizen who called and complained wasn't able to give any specifics other than he thought the person was rude. And I asked him, I said, well, did he use profanity? No. Did he contradict you or interrupt you? Well, not really, but he was just rude. And so he wasn't able to say why, but there was something that bothered him about the contact. I was out on the street one time, shortly thereafter that, he got dispatched to a complaint at a service station. And I pulled off alongside the road and watched him. And he was, you know, real close to the person, and he kept touching the person and talking to him. You know, he was just talking to him, but kind of like patting him on the shoulder. And we have a space. For an officer, that space is very important, because when you get that close, the person has access to your weapons for officer safety, as well as just a common respect of the person you're talking to. I said that, look, you know, I said, don't touch people. Keep your distance, you know. And he says, well, I was telling him I was sorry. I said, no. Maintain professional attitude all the time. You don't need to pat him on the shoulder. And no, he would pout. It was almost juvenile, I guess.
While Joseph DeAngelo is working as an officer at the Auburn Police Department, the East Area Rapist is routinely breaking into homes and raping women a short distance away in Sacramento, as many as 4 a month.
Property crimes is one of the major crimes that we have in this area, so it would have been routine for him to respond.
As burglary victims in Auburn call the cops to respond to these crimes, it's possible that it's the East Area Rapist who shows up at their doorstep in a police uniform. But then, in July 1979, the East Area Rapist attacks come to an end. This occurs at the same time that Joseph DeAngelo is fired from the Auburn Police Department for shoplifting.
He was arrested for shoplifting a hammer as well as a can of dog repellent. He was arrested by the Sacramento Sheriff's Department. Upon hearing that, we suspended him and started our investigation. That investigation lasted about a month. He was terminated in August. He filed an appeal, and he pled not guilty to the theft. He went to court on the charge. Matter of fact, he had a jury trial, testified, and he was found guilty. And so he was, at that point, officially gone from the Auburn Police Department. I have no idea why would a police officer be shoplifting. After the incident occurred, several officers had said that he had all sorts of tools in his garage, officers that had been over to his house. And I think one officer said, well, he had 2 or 3 drills still in the box. So it kind of appeared to us that maybe he had been shoplifting for a while.
What's the significance of the shoplifting? Was it to avoid looking suspicious, buying things that he would later use to commit crimes? Was it forensic sophistication because he knew that they'd be able to track these items back to him? Or was it because he's a psychopath who craves excitement?
Somewhere in that period, I received a call from the city's worker comp adjuster, and he told me that Joe had filed a workers' comp claim. He said the stress of the job had caused him to commit the theft. And he was blaming the stress of the job on me. And because I fired him and I didn't like him, you know. The adjuster also told me that D'Angelo said he came to my house to kill me, but couldn't find my bedroom. And even then, to be honest with you, I just didn't believe it. Joe D'Angelo just did not strike me as that type of person that could do something like that. But still, no, police officers do get threatened. And as a police officer, my number one responsibility is my family. And so we talked about it as a family, what to do if someone strange comes to the house.
We know that in 1979, a prowler woke up Nick Willick's 4-year-old daughter in the middle of the night by shining a flashlight into her window. But what we don't know is, why didn't he break in?
Even today, that is a big question in my mind. Why didn't he enter my house? There was nothing exceptional about the house. There were no sophisticated locks or anything on it. Even afterwards, you know, like, why would he admit to that? I mean, he must have been smart enough to know that when you make that type of claim, that's going to be reported. I don't know. I don't have that answer.
A question that Nick Willick thinks he can answer is whether or not an Auburn police officer could commit these attacks while on duty.
No. The answer to that is definitely no. Oftentimes, there would only be two officers on the street. When you went to a call, your other officers responded and backed you up. And he was just, it would have been difficult for him, impossible for that to happen. A sergeant would not have allowed him. And if he was missing, he would have known that. His days off and during his vacations, it's not that far away. It was a 30, 35-minute drive. He could have committed the crimes, absolutely. I've seen on social media, should have known. I don't know how I should have known. Trust me, I beat myself up better than anybody does. I'm very difficult, hard on myself. And Joe D'Angelo was he was an embarrassment to all the tens of thousands of good men and women who put their lives on the line every day. And you have someone like Joe D'Angelo that really harms that image because it's a rarity. Joe D'Angelo was not a police officer. He was a person masquerading as a police officer.
The Golden State Killer commits his next attack in October 1979, over 400 miles south of Sacramento. And this is where we lose track of Joseph D'Angelo's whereabouts. He moves out of Auburn, but exactly where he goes is still a mystery. At the time of this recording, few details of his timeline are known. We do know that back in 1973, the Sacramento Bee announced that then 27-year-old Joseph D'Angelo married 20-year-old Sharon Huddle. It's also been reported that in the late 1970s, Joseph D'Angelo asked his brother-in-law, James, "What do you think of that East Area rapist? What would you do, Jim?" To which James Huddle replied, "If he got his hands on him, he'd attack him." We know the first of Joseph D'Angelo and Sharon Huddle's three daughters was born in 1981, 6 weeks after Sherry Domingo and Gregory Sanchez were murdered. We also know that in 1983, the family moved into the same Citrus Heights home where 35 years later, Joseph D'Angelo was arrested. Shortly after Janelle Cruz was murdered in 1986, D'Angelo's second daughter was born. Sharon Huddle gave birth to their third daughter in 1989. The same year that Joseph D'Angelo began working as a trailer mechanic at Save Mart. In April 2018, when Joseph D'Angelo was arrested at home and later accused of 50 rapes and 13 murders, the story was broadcast and celebrated worldwide. But in Sacramento, his closest friends were shocked and struggled to comprehend that the man they knew as a neighbor, co-worker, and friend had been arrested for the monstrous crimes of the Golden State Killer.
My name is Richard Mangang, and I was Joe D'Angelo's closest friend. To me, he was Joe instead of Joseph. I first met Joe in 2007. He was a trailer mechanic, and I was a driver. It's funny, the way we met, I heard two guys, or actually three guys, chiming in on about fishing. And I, you know, being a fisherman, I love fishing. I just happened to jump into conversation, and our friendship began there. He took me on his boat a couple weeks later, and just hit it off.
My name is Bill Helms, and I was Joe DeAngelo's co-worker and friend for 11 years, 3 months. We worked the same shift, 40 hours a week. I don't want to say that Joe was a nice guy, because he wasn't. I think there was two Joes. I think there was Joseph DeAngelo and Joe DeAngelo. And the Joe DeAngelo is the one I knew. When I first met Joe, I wanted to kill him. He was real hard to get along with. And after about 5 years, I finally realized that we have to coexist. We don't have to like each other, but be civil to each other. And then we started liking each other, you know? I mean, I knew what made him mad, so I didn't do it. He knew what made me mad, and he did it still, but anyway. Joe was, he had his good points, but I guess he had a lot worse points than he did good.
When I first met Joe, I thought he was different. I was like, well, why does this guy want to fish with me? There's a lot of racism in this world, and people view things different, you know, than other folks. And there's a few guys on the job would come out and say, why would you take that black guy with you? But see, what they didn't realize, Joe has a granddaughter that's half black. And I didn't know that until I met her finally. I would wonder that too up until that point.
There was one whole year that I didn't speak to Joe at all, not one word. One time I was changing a windshield on a truck that just came off the road, and it was 105 degrees that day, and I had my own personal fan pointed up at me, and he walked over and twice turned that fan off. He didn't want to hear it roaring, and I had to climb down off the top of the engine where I was standing and turn it back on. And I told him the second time I turned it back on that if he turned it off again, I was going to break his fucking hand. And I really meant it. Every night he'd have a different issue with a different person. I've heard more four-letter words thrown at Joe than you could ever imagine. We had a boss one time that would humiliate Joe and really treated Joe crappy. We've all talked about it at work, you know, and if he's going to kill anybody, it probably would have been him.
We were fishing at Folsom Lake one time, and there were some ladies on the beach. And he said, what if one of them come over here? Or what if one of them get naked, just run out here? What would you do? How would you react? And I said, you know how I react. I'd jump off your boat. I'd be over there. He said, yeah, I know you'd leave me, huh? He said, yeah. And then there was another time. We were fishing. Some guys came by. A lot of fishermen, when you're fishing in your area, they don't want to be disturbed. Okay. Like some guys came to disturb the water. Joe actually, you know, got close to him and let him know how he felt about that. There were a few times I seen him angry, you know, but that's how Joe was. He was never quiet, never quiet. He'd let you know verbally, very loud, very loud. Yeah, he'd holler sometimes. In fact, there was many times me and him argued about little things, crazy things, you know. I might drop some liver blood on his boat and I'd wipe it up immediately, and he'd get mad and we'd start arguing. That was late at night, in the dark, on the water. There was never a time I was scared, because he would tell me, you know, I have your life in my hands, and I would say the same for you. Because we out here together. But he was captain of the boat. But now that I look back, I think like, ooh, God's been looking after me. Because people at work tell me, you know, he must have really liked you. You know, because all the times I hear about you guys arguing, he never, you know, tried anything with you, you know. So I was truly blessed.
See those white things over there by the top of the boat? The white PVC stuff? Those are off of his boat. The day that he dropped those off here was the day that he went and stopped at a Hobby Lobby when they swabbed the side of his car. They were watching him even when he came here. I've been to his house lots of times. Joe's house was real nice. Everything was perfect. He had Roman tiles, just all brand new. He had bookshelves custom made for the walls so they fit. Redid his kitchen. I mean, there wasn't a blade of grass out of place there, you know. He did have model airplanes on the kitchen table. He used to have little drag boats, gas-powered drag boats. But one time I went over there and he goes, hey, you want to see my girlfriends? I go, yeah, I want to see this. So I followed him into the bedroom, and he had two beds in the bedroom, and he had six nice fishing poles laying on one of them. He was, I think he'd given up on women by then. And he was just a fisherman.
Joseph DeAngelo and Sharon Huddle separated in 1991.
In an odd twist, Sharon Huddle is a divorce attorney. But at the time of D'Angelo's arrest, they were still married.
She didn't live with him. He said he was married for, you know, tax purposes and so she'd get medical and stuff. But he never really said a whole lot. I know that he put his daughters through medical school. That's why he worked so long. He worked an extra 7 years at Save Mart, past what he had to. He's probably got to be sorry he did that now. But he did, you know. I don't know if it's because they say he murdered a man and woman that were doctors. I wouldn't think that that's why he did this, but maybe he thought he was trying to better the world by putting doctors out there. All three of his daughters are doctors.
When I first met Joe, he didn't reveal much of his past. And, you know, as time went on, he started telling me little things about his life. He told me when he was a little kid that they were very poor. For fun, he would go down to the lake and skip rocks off the water. That was the only fun they had. And his mom would go sometimes without eating, just so they can eat. Their clothes weren't the best. He didn't talk much about his dad. He didn't talk about his sisters either, you know, and he has a couple, but he didn't talk much about them at all. And as he was older, he never told me about things that have come out now, such as being a police officer. I never knew about that. I never knew he went to college. I guess, he told me what he wanted everyone to know.
Joe never told me anything about his past. He talked about his mother from time to time, but I don't remember him ever talking about his dad. Well, I was there when he found out his mom died, and he's pretty upset about it. He actually used my phone to call and find out. Now I know why. It was in Ventura. I don't think he wanted any trace that Ventura, you know, to be on any trace of the phone, you know, where he worked. Both because we have a recorded line at work. I thought it was a little strange. One time Joe told me, sometimes I do things that I can't explain.
He would say that, I'm so lucky. He was set up. His house paid off. New boat, new car, new truck, new motorcycle. Just remodeled his house. Had no bills, you know, but everyday expenses for living. No bills. He retired, so he felt blessed. Now, I don't know if he was referring to the things that everybody's accusing him of, or he's being accused of. Whether he was blessed not to get caught for those, I don't know. He would say that all the time. I am so lucky, huh, Richard? I'm lucky, huh? Yeah, I'm really lucky.
I found out about Joe's arrest. We heard on the news that they found possibly the East Side Rapist and that he lived in Citrus Heights on Canyon Oak Drive. And I was pouring a cup of coffee, and I go, my God, Joe lives on Canyon Oak Drive. Figured it might be one of his neighbors. So I go running around where Lynn's watching TV on the news, and I go, oh, my God, that's Joe's house. Those are Joe's cars. And she goes, no way. And then they said, Joseph D'Angelo's just been arrested.
I went to work that day. Clocked in at 11. Everybody in the office was like, Richard, have you heard? I said, no, what are you talking about? And they said, you haven't watched the news. And they said, Joe's been arrested. I said, for what? And they said, go watch the news. So I went to the break room and watched the news. And there his house was. There were a lot of cops in front of his house. His boat was out. Cars were out. And then I seen it was posted under the picture on the screen what was going on. And I was like, no, it can't be. I did my truck inspection, got in the truck, and was going out the gate. And one of the supervisors came up to me and said, you all right, Richard? And then I guess it just hit me hard. I'd start watering, tears, and everything else. But that's how I learned about Joe's arrest at work. And was I affected by it big time?
So right now I'm standing in front of D'Angelo's driveway.
On the day of the arrest, Joseph D'Angelo's quiet neighborhood was bombarded first by law enforcement and then by the media. Months later, there's still occasional media activity. Neighbors peek out their windows, wondering when this attention will end. Today's no different, and Paul spots Natalia and Eric peeking out the window, a few doors down from Joseph D'Angelo's home. And Paul can't help doing what he's done for the past 24 years. Gather more information on the Golden State Killer.
Yeah, he was in Detroit on business.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
When the arrest happened.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All
right. I was, I called him up. I'm like, you know, Freak? Because that's what we called him. Yeah. Well, they just carried him off. Apparently he was a serial killer and rapist.
Now, why did you guys call him Freak?
Because he used to freak out on the driveway all the time.
What does that mean? What was he doing?
Everybody talking about he'd have his tirades on the driveway. He would just start yelling and cursing and stuff like that.
And is he saying any names?
No, he was just general cursing. And
just at himself?
Yeah.
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 Or he lost his keys. And Where are my effing keys, you know?
Joe would lose his keys. You know, he'd be trying to find him. I seen Joe cut off probably 5 or 6 padlocks off his locker over the years. Yeah, he would talk to himself sometimes at night. Oh, my God, what did I do in my last life to deserve this? Well, now we know.
He would get angry about small things. You can't find your keys. He'd go off.
And he's yelling at the top of his lungs.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd see him out in front.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He would. In fact, when he would freak out like that, we would and go back into our home. You could still hear him from inside the house.
Yeah. You're seeing him actually out and about during the day.
Oh, yeah. He would take meticulous care of his lawn. He mowed it. He liked it nice and short, and then he would get down on his hands and knees and hand clip around all those decorative rocks.
Oh, wow. Now, when you first moved in, do you remember what kind of cars he was driving?
He had a really old...
Sentra?
Yeah, Toyota. He's always a Toyota guy.
His Toyota, what car was it? Or what color was it?
White. It was white, yeah.
It was white, and when you say really old, like what? How old?
Well, I mean, it's like an older style...
Like the 80s.
Sentra.
80s.
You know, like, yeah.
He did have a bicycle that he used to ride, and he had the spandex he would put on and ride his bicycle. And then he also had a motorcycle that he used to ride.
Okay.
A motorcycle. And
Now, the bicycle, was that a 10-speed style racing road bike?
Okay. No.
Not like a mountain bike style?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, just your, typical... Yeah.
And how long ago was that? Was that he was putting on the spandex and doing that?
Like a few years.
Like
recently.
Relatively
recently. The arrest. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So when we saw him on the news in the wheelchair, we were laughing because I was like, oh please,
right.
Oh please.
I agree with you.
So the neighbors behind them, and Paul, you probably know more about it than we do, is that. They have had a dog. I don't know if they still have it, but it would bark. And Joe hates dogs. And so the dog would be barking during the day. And of course, he's home during the day. So he actually went around to their backyard. He went around the block and went into the backyard and threatened the mom. And I don't remember exactly what he said, but threatened her. And so that scared the, poop out of him.
But he also left a voice message on their machine, too. And I think, according to the story that they tell, is that they recognized it was Joe's voice.
Yeah.
You know, I think when you see something like this on the news, it's always like, they're always saying, oh, we never would have suspected him, right? And I think a lot of people here, were thinking, of all the people in the neighborhood for this... to be the guy, pieces started falling into place, because how he behaved and stuff like that,
And that's interesting. I know I've, over the course of my investigation, had many suspects I was looking into, and of course talking to, coworkers and friends, oh, it couldn't be him, and
right.
I could never rely upon that because of what you're just saying, because how often do you see in the news, I never would have suspected it was him.
Right.
But it's interesting that now... we've identified him.
Yes.
The personality aspects are coming out where you guys are going, we can kind of see it.
Yeah, and I can totally see the anger.
We feel sorry for the daughters and the granddaughters.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Of course the victims, but also the family.
Yeah.
And find out that your father and grandfather...
And in many ways, they're his last victims.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very true. Very true.
It is so unfortunate that they're having to live through that.
For decades, investigators in 11 California counties, FBI agents, and online sleuths around the world have worked tirelessly to identify the Golden State Killer. Armed with evidence of what he did, they hunted for his name. Who is he? Now, although we may have that answer, there's still one gaping hole in the case.
Why did he do it? And he may never tell us. But his victims have something to tell him.
The message that I hope that he gets from me, no matter how that happens, maybe it's from this recording right here. Somehow I want him to get a message from me that says, you did not get away with this. I want him to know that he thought all of his evil deeds were going to be secret forever, that nobody would ever know. And he was wrong. We know it all now. We don't have to know the details, but we know it all.
Chapter 14, Epilogue. Finally, evil has a name. In the summer of 2018, Joseph James DeAngelo was led into court. And for the first time, his victims laid eyes on the man accused of raping and terrorizing them or murdering their loved ones. Except this time, the victims could see his face. They knew his name. And he's the one who was bound.
I've struggled with this for 32 years, but I am glad that I can finally see who did it.
Jane Carson Sandler traveled from South Carolina.
I was sitting in the front row on the right side, and I began to sob, and I still don't know to this day. Why was I crying? Why was I sobbing? I've always been so strong. I've never broken down before. And my first reaction when seeing him was anger.
Debbie Domingo McMillan came from Texas.
That courthouse in particular is set up in such a way that his instructions are face forward, face towards the judge, do not make eye contact or engage or speak to anyone who is present in the gallery. Thank God for that safeguard because I wasn't worried about this 72-year-old man trying to do something physically to me. I wasn't scared in that way. But I had this apprehension just about what the vibe in the room would be if that ugliness, if that evil spirit was going to be something that I would feel.
And Margaret Wardlow came from San Diego.
I was sitting behind him and I could see his neck. And his neck has these deep sun wrinkles in it. And I just kept thinking, like, this guy's been out riding his motorcycle. He's been out fishing. And I was just catapulted back into the body and feelings of a 13-year-old girl. It was just horrible.
At the time of this recording, Joseph James DeAngelo is being held at a Sacramento County jail awaiting trial for murder and other charges.
Prosecutors can't charge Joseph James DeAngelo with rape due to statute of limitations, but they can charge him with kidnapping to commit robbery in 13 cases in Sacramento and Contra Costa counties in the late 70s. That's in addition to the 13 murders across the state for which he's already been charged.
My name is Anne Marie Schubert, and I am the District Attorney of Sacramento County. So there's Tulare County, Contra Costa County, Ventura County, Santa Barbara County, Orange County, Sacramento County. You know, there's other counties that are involved that I don't believe are charged at this point, but it cuts across many counties. It really is historic. We all came together and formed a team. That team is representative of all of these cases, and so are these counties. This is a case of historic magnitudes that affected really the entire state.
I guess they had to consult the California Supreme Court to see if we could charge him with all the crimes in one jurisdiction, which will be Sacramento County. And they made the decision that could be done. And so I was there for that hearing and I started crying. It was just, it was too much. Once they started reading all the names of the murder victims and many of those families that I know, it was just too traumatic. From what I understand, my attack won't be part of those charges.
In California, kidnapping is defined as moving another person a substantial distance without that person's consent by using force or fear.
Number one, I was in my room the entire time. I was never moved from one place to another. And of course, the statute of limitations ran out long ago on my attack. And it's unfortunate because, you know, I was a child and a minor at the time, but it's still the same situation.
Prosecutors are looking at all the East Area Rapist attacks, including Jane's, to see which cases might be charged. All of the original Night Stalker murders will be tried.
I'm so glad it's over. I'm so glad it's over. And I can enjoy life. You know, now I gotta figure out what I want to do with my time. I don't feel like talking about it anymore.
Now that that's over and done with, I survived that 3 minutes in the courtroom with him. Nothing tragic happened. The world didn't explode. I'm okay.
My tearful response before seeing D'Angelo in court surprised me. But I can honestly say again, I've met so many wonderful, caring people over the years. I remain in close contact with Inspector Shelby, Larry Crompton, Paul Holes, Carol Daly.
Carol Daly still talks with many of the victims she helped through the horrific first hours and days after their attacks. She's now retired, but her cell phone still buzzes with calls from the women she assisted.
I talked to Margaret, and she was always this very strong and defiant. And she went to court, and she saw the man who was responsible for her attack, and she fell to pieces. All of these victims who thought they had it all together, they see his picture, they go to court. Jane sobbed, cried and cried. And I have not gone to any of the court proceedings. I don't want to be there. I was at the press conference when they made the announcement. And one of the first questions, they said, well, what did you say when you saw his picture? And I said, I didn't look at his picture. What, you didn't see his picture? I'm not going to look evil in the face. There was not a night in 42 years that I went to sleep and did not think about these victims. I have never forgotten what it was like for them to lay in bed and open their eyes and see this masked figure at the end of the bed with a flashlight or a gun or a knife and telling them, don't move, don't move. And I worked some really horrific homicide cases. Some of them I remember, most of them I don't. But with the East Area Rapist, it's like I'm sitting down and interviewing a victim and I can remember everything that he did.
Even after Joseph D'Angelo's arrest, the original investigators, Larry Crompton and Richard Shelby, are still reassessing their work on the Golden State Killer case.
When I found out that he was arrested, I wanted to talk to him. I wanted to be face to face with him and ask him, what did I miss? What did I do wrong? What could we have done differently? Did I come close?
My wife and I were talking about what is evil. I view evil as the total absence of good. He's pure evil.
It's taken its toll. But I'm so happy for the officers that over the years have worked this as a cold case and were able to be there at the time of the arrest, you know, like Paul Holes. How great it would have been if we could have celebrated back then.
The original investigators spent years chasing around a shadow in the dark, never limited by competence or passion, only by technology and science.
I believe genetic genealogy will revolutionize the way we solve crime in this country and really in this world.
You know, if you take the Golden State Killer case, 40 plus years of investigation and all the resources and time that went into it and all the dedication of the investigators, both past and present, that worked on it. And then with using investigative genetic genealogy, we were able to solve it in a very short time period. It's definitely a game changer for sure.
This investigative genealogy tool has proven itself, not only in the Golden State Killer case, but now in other cases.
Well, I think there's no secret, but the NorCal rapist case was the most recent one.
The NorCal rapist was a two-decade-old cold case that was thought to be unsolvable. Following the success of the Golden State Killer case using genealogy, the same team at the Sacramento DA's office, Kirk and Monica, closed the NorCal rapist case in a matter of weeks.
An investigator on the case, Paul Holes, told San Jose Mercury News that GetMatch offered police a large pool of profiles and didn't require a court order.
I absolutely understand where individuals are concerned about their privacy.
Within some communities, there's a dislike of doing anything that smacks of being involved with, quote, government type things or putting things into databases like this.
They're reading in these newspapers, law enforcement accessing genetic information. I think it's important for these people to understand that
at no stage in this investigative genealogy process are we accessing anybody's genetic information. Mm-hmm. In order to see their genetic information, I have to have their DNA profile. Their DNA profile is up in that database. There is no way for me to be able to download that DNA profile. I can't see it. All I'm getting out of the search of the database is how much DNA is shared between that person in the database and the Golden State Killer's DNA.
Despite privacy issues that some may have, it's hard to argue against the fact that investigative genealogy ultimately does good.
I gave a presentation in Burbank earlier this year, and a woman came up to me afterwards. She could barely talk. She was crying. And she said, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." She said, "Two of my friends were victims of the Golden State Killer." And she said, you don't know how much this has done for them, because basically for 30 years, they've been worried that he's going to show up and kill them. What I would really like to do is get the message out that if people want to help catch criminals, that they would please go out and do DNA testing someplace, any place, and upload their raw DNA data files to GenMatch.
Another message that I really like to convey to victims of violent crime is that someone perpetrated an evil act upon you, but you do not have to own that. You do not have to walk this earth carrying that with you all the time. You're not guilty of anything. You can move beyond that. There's life beyond that sort of black cloud.
Men, significant others, husbands that have been with a female when she was attacked, they also need therapy. They need therapy just as much as women do.
Try not to shut your family and friends out. It's important, and what I've learned these last few years, it's important, it is therapeutic, it is healing to seek answers and to seek out support, to talk to other victims and survivors, to stay close and connected to your own family, your own friends. There are several of us who have developed such close relationships that we call ourselves the sister survivors. They understand where I've been and what I've gone through. Our mission now is to build a network and to be there for each other and to be there for other survivors. And if you feel alone, trust me, you are not alone.
Many survivors of the Golden State Killer and the family members of his murder victims have found a way to move forward and live rich, fulfilling lives.
I have four kids, and they are 12, 14, 21, and 23. I have two boys and two girls.
I am married to a wonderful man from Texas. We have five grown children and five grandchildren. I work for the Texas prison system, and I've been in corrections for almost 15 years.
I'm a stay-at-home mom. Yeah, I have a daughter who's 19 now.
I'm happily married to a wonderful man. Besides living with him, I live with three cats and a dog.
It was a monumental scientific breakthrough that finally led to an arrest in the Golden State Killer case. But for many people who worked it, and for the victims they served, one name stands out.
He probably doesn't toot his own horn enough, but you know, if it wasn't for Paul, I don't feel like any of this would have happened.
Yeah, I can't say enough about Paul and really championing this idea.
That key decision from Paul Holes to pull out the Contra Costa cases and to take a closer look, I just thank the Lord every day that Paul did that.
Little did I know that back in 1994, when I first started digging into this East Area Rapist series, that it would end up consuming me and take almost half of my life to get to the point where we finally identified who that person was. I think about the victims that I developed relationships with over those 24 years and hearing their appreciation for finally knowing who had attacked them and seeing that there could be justice in their cases. It was well worth the time and effort. You know, I sit back now and take a look at it, and I recognize that it was quite an accomplishment. But this was an accomplishment that was done by multiple people. I was just fortunate that I met the right people at the right time, and the technology had gotten to a point to where we were able to close the case out. So I retired at the end of March 2018. I've recently learned that Joseph DeAngelo also retired at the end of March 2018. It looks like we literally may have retired on the same day. I would say my retirement is going a little bit better than his.
This Audible original series is dedicated to the many victims attacked by the Golden State Killer, their family members and loved ones, and the committed public servants who brought him to justice.
This is Evil Has a Name, an Audible original written by Paul Holes, Jim Clemente, Peter McDonald, and Mitch Hansen. Evil Has a Name was produced by Audible with XG Productions and executive produced by Jim Clemente, Peter McDonald, and Colin Campbell. This series was sound designed and mixed by Alex Spitroth and Sean Cromwell. Music provided by 21 South Music. Dialogue editing by Mike Thal. Field recording by Greg Stridham and Sean Cromwell. In-studio recording by Julian Nicholson, Glenn Ferguson, and Eric Cifuentes at the Invisible Studios in Los Angeles. Story consulting by Francie Hakes, Mariana Clemente, James Bruce, and Justin Wiley. XG's Chief Counsel and Business Affairs is Spencer Gordon. Archival audio courtesy of KOVR, Cap Radio Inc., and the Sacramento County District Attorney's Office. Special thanks to Maggie Murphy, David Bloom, Jessica Radburn, Jillian Moranga, Vanessa Harris, Kat Johnson, and Reed Armbruster.
This series features the voices of Paul Holes, Jim Clemente, Jane Carson Sandler, Michelle Cruz, Debbie Domingo McMullen, Margaret Wardlow, Larry Crompton, Carol Daly, Richard Shelby, Larry Montgomery, Larry Poole, Steve Rhodes, Barbara Ray Venter, Anne-Marie Schubert, Nick Willick, Kirk Campbell, Monica Tchaikovsky, Bill Helms, Richard Mangang, and Natalia Bides-Correnti.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.